Hello and welcome to volume 109 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about the long-term residential housing trends, and we'll talk about active management and focusing on crop trees. We'll talk about taxes, and we'll find out what's happening in Congress. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Last week, U.S. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp introduced a draft tax reform proposal. It covers a lot of things, and when it comes to forest ownership and responsible management, there are a number of things that you probably won't like. Dave Tenney with NAFO is a returning guest, and he can help us understand this. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Why is Chairman Camp's draft tax proposal a threat to forest owners?
Well, first of all, let me just say that reforming the tax code is probably not a bad idea overall. I think probably a lot of people think that's not a bad idea. But what typically happens is in the zeal to get there, sometimes you start looking at the fine print and realize that maybe the path to get there has some unintended consequences, and that's what we're experiencing here. Basically, what the Camp proposal suggests is to reclassify timber, which in a way that would treat it as inventory rather than as real property. And that is a change of precedent that goes all the way back to 1863. You can imagine what that would do to the investment in timberland over long periods of time, basically saying that timber is no longer a long-term capital asset. It's a widget that should be counted in your inventory. That's a fundamental restructuring of the entire business model for owning and managing timber.
Okay, so long-term capital gains treatment that we're accustomed to, that would be affected by that.
Yes.
And also reforestation expenses?
Yep, he would propose eliminating reforestation expenses. And along with the elimination of the capital gains treatment, he would also propose fundamental restructuring of how we account for the costs associated with growing timber over time. And I should add as well that the Camp proposal would eliminate real estate investment trusts in timber, which is a fairly common investment strategy for a lot of forest owners and investors.
All right. What do you see the consequences? What's at risk if these provisions are taken out of the current tax code?
Well, in terms of dollars, we did some research some time ago looking at the provisions in the tax code that are peculiar to forestry and forest management. If they're eliminated, our research shows that we're probably looking at least a 15% annual decline in our forestry and timber sales. That's about $34 billion and could rack up as many as 140,000 jobs lost in the industry.
Now, I want to emphasize this is a draft tax proposal that's been floated out there, and there's likely nothing that will happen between now and the next month or two, but what can forest owners do to help preserve these provisions? What should we do now?
Well, there's an old saying in Washington that if you're not at the table, chances are you're on the menu, and we've become part of a menu. Now, the Camp proposal is a menu of options for lawmakers who are out looking for revenue. They propose savings. Eliminating these provisions in the tax code results, at least in theory, in certain savings. And so if you're trying to pay for something out there, then you can pick and choose from this menu. Our task now is to make sure that Congress understands clearly the impacts of these proposals should they be considered seriously by anyone going forward. NAFO is working on rallying the industry in letters to both Chairman Camp and his colleagues and to Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden, just to make sure that they understand that this is an unacceptable approach to tax reform. And the role of individual landowners will be played out over time through their associations, as we call them, the associations, to invite the grassroots to weigh in with these critical members as well.
Okay. So while there's not a vote scheduled on this, it's certainly a menu of options, and the time is now to begin to get your voice known.
We got to put the genie back into the bottle and make sure it doesn't come out again.
All right. Thank you, Dave. We appreciate that. Dr. Jordan Rappaport's a senior economist at Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City. He's looked at the overall trends in demographics and related those to their effect on residential construction. Welcome, Dr. Rappaport.
Thank you. Let me just start with a quick disclaimer that these are my views and not necessarily those of the Kansas City Fed or the Federal Reserve System.
Okay. Very good. We appreciate it. Well, tell us your view on these things. And first, I wanted to get you to explain the term demographic and tell us about some of the likely changes in the population groups that we might see in the next few years.
So demographics just refers to the size and age composition and other things that define, you know, the composition of the U.S. population. It could be ethnicity, gender. And so the big story here, which is no surprise, is the aging of the baby boom. As people age, and when we look at behavior in the past, we see that they tend to move from single-family homes to multifamily homes, and just this is the downsizing that people talk about sometimes. And, you know, that if we look at how people behaved in the past and we project that forward, we see that there's going to be a huge shift in demand from single-family homes to multifamily homes.
Okay. How do you expect the near-term demographic trends to affect residential construction specifically?
In the near term, I think the key thing is that everyone recognizes, and my research recognizes, that we're below trend in the sense that there's this gap that's built up during the recession. But my research suggests it's a lot smaller than people think. It's about 2% of the single-family stock. That's about 1.6 million homes that we need to make up for the slow construction over the last 5 years. There are estimates that are twice or three times that. And so my near-term, this research's near-term projection is that we should see about growth in the 10, this is all about single family, growth in the 10 to 15% rate in starts over the next 3 years, and then we wouldn't hit 1 million single family starts until about 2017. The flip side is that multifamily is booming and it should continue to boom.
Okay. You wrote a paper which was called The Long-Term Outlook for U.S. Residential Constructions, and in that paper you wrote that even under optimistic assumptions, overall residential construction is projected to enter an extended decline by the early 2020s. Tell us what you can about how you compare the long-term projected construction numbers to today's numbers, and then what your projections are for the future.
So I guess, I mean, there are two trends that are sort of playing out. There are several trends that are playing out. One, U.S. population growth is slowing, so that will put downward demand over the long term on residential construction. Then you have this aging, which is shifting demand from single family to multifamily. And finally, we have this catch-up to make up for the lost homes that weren't constructed over the last 5 years. And so that catch-up is going to fuel growth and eventually bring single-family construction to a peak of about 1.3 million homes in the early 2020s. But then once we've closed that gap, then all you get left is the downward trend in demand for single-family. So where single-family might peak in the early 2020s at about 1.3 million, by 15 years later, I think it's going to be more like, the projection is more like 900,000. It's just going to be the steady downward trend on starts for a decade or more.
Okay. Well, thank you for helping us look around the corner on those things, Dr. Rappaport. We appreciate it very much. Recently, there's been some discussion about how Southern Pine Lumber is graded for its strength properties. Dave Jones is a professor at Mississippi State and has recently given a lecture in which he drives home the point that what we do in the forest changes the products that we produce. So we wanted to check in with him and learn some more. Hello, Professor Jones.
Hey, how are you?
How has the quality of wood that we're growing changed?
Well, it's a tricky question because the quality of the wood itself has not necessarily changed, but more so the age of the wood that we're getting out of the forest has changed. We're able to get a much larger tree in a shorter period of time, meaning that the makeup of the wood that we're utilizing is more towards the juvenile or the early fast growth of the tree than the mature wood where we traditionally found.
How are the mills then affected by these changes in the way that we're acting out in the woods?
Well, the biggest change is the strength values of the lumber have decreased because the makeup is more of that juvenile material found inside the tree. And so a lot of the mills have had to make adjustments based on that and have added equipment into their mills to test that lumber to know what the actual strength is.
What impact has this change had on landowners, and what will the impact be in the future?
Well, the big impact that has occurred to landowners has been that along with, of course, the housing market, we haven't seen an increase as demand has gone up, an increase in the price of timber as much as we would have expected to have seen had we not come across the issues with the strength values. In the long term for landowners, there's two things that we're probably going to see. There's probably going to be a differentiation in the market for the higher quality wood because the mills will be able to make more diverse products out of them, which is something we haven't seen in the past. But we'll also see a clear lower grade market develop that will probably be primarily made up of thinnings and cuttings of material that is mostly juvenile wood.
So you might see a split in the market between the typical pine plantation wood that grows very fast versus grade lumber, which is a slower grown, possibly, you know, a natural stand or something like that.
That's right. And that's something that we've kind of expected to happen for the last 10 or 15 years. It just never materialized, primarily because the housing market was so strong for so long that any tree that we could get out of the forest had a home. And now that the market's a little bit slower, we're seeing the possibility of some of that differentiation. And the instrumentation that they're putting in the mills to do measurements on individual boards will allow those mills to make those decisions and decide, I'll take this stand of trees, but I won't take that stand of trees.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Jones. Lenny Farley is an extension specialist at Purdue University. He works in an area called crop tree management, and that's well-suited for small forest ownerships. Hello, Lenny.
Good to be with you today.
Do you have some ideas about how landowners can more easily manage trees to meet their own woodland management objectives?
Yeah, sometimes it's difficult for folks to think about what trees do I actually want to favor and how do I go about doing that. And one of the things we want to do is think about our management objectives for our properties, what we hope to accomplish, and then recognize there are some trees out there that are going to help us achieve those objectives better than others, and then it makes sense to manage for the growth and vigor of those trees through time.
Okay. What trees make good crop trees?
A lot of it depends on your objectives. If we're thinking about managing for timber, we want to think about trees with good potential quality for developing high-quality logs and lumber, and then also trees that have maintained good value through time in the marketplaces where these folks have their properties. And then also think about sites that are going to be able to support the growth of those trees through time.
When you talk about managing a crop tree, what exactly are you talking about?
Yeah, number one, we select trees that are going to have the potential to respond to the release that we provide them. And so we're looking for trees with nice straight stems and already relatively healthy crowns that are pretty competitive with other trees. And then we actually go through a process of eliminating the competition around that tree so it's got plenty of space to grow. And that's called a crown-touching release. Essentially, we're looking at the crown of that tree, and we're going to thin the trees that touch that crown, that live crown area, to provide maximum growing space for that tree to do its best development through possibly the next 10 or 15 years of growth.
Okay. Well, thanks, Lenny. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Henry Barclay is a noted tax specialist for forest owners. He was one of our guests on Issue 1 of Capital Ideas Live in July 2000. And he's returned several times. And this time we heard about a talk that he gave and thought we'd get a summary of it. Hello, Henry.
Hey there, Hayes. How are you this morning?
Quite well. I wanted to ask you about the talk that you gave at the recent meeting of the Alabama Forest Resources Council, where you said that there were several changes in the tax code made in 2013. These are ones that are already in there, unlike things that are proposed, as we heard from Dave Tenney. But these are actually there, and they're going to be felt this year. Give us a rundown.
Yeah, I would say on the also as a plug, the Forest Landowners Tax Council, for which I'm president, is also fully on board with doing something with these camp proposals. So we're looking at those very carefully. Also, as to this point, generally this year we're going to find income is up, income tax is up. I have several clients who are paying more than two times the amount of taxes that they were paying last year on exactly the same income. So one thing that influences it that would be interesting to timber owners is the fact that if you have capital gains over about $400,000, you're subject to long-term capital gains rates of 20% federal, which is a 33 1/3% increase from the 15% previously. And, of course, with Alabama tax, that'll be a 20% tax. Also, there's an investment income tax. It's a surcharge for incomes with net investment income over $200,000, and that surtax is 3.8%.
Okay, so you've mentioned some guidelines on investment income. One is $200,000, in which the Medicare surtax charge occurs, and then the other one is when you get the bump up in long-term capital gains rate, and that's in the $400,000 to $450,000 range. So you have mentioned the Medicare surcharge, and you've also talked previously about a passive and active trap that's lurking in that Medicare surcharge. What is that, and how can you avoid it?
Yeah, there's an interesting definition in the health care law, the ACA, and the definition in that law says that passive income is net investment income. So if I have a business and I don't materially participate in that business, that would be many of our forest landowners who have formed LLCs or LLPs. They have subchapter S corporations, and they have they as an individual may actively participate, but they have gifted their interests and limited interest to other people. Those folks don't actively participate, and their income is subject to net investment income tax. And I think there are going to be some real surprises this year when people find out that they're paying that 3.8% tax.
Okay, to support Obamacare then.
Yes.
Okay. In the past, you've encouraged forest owners to keep a log of their forest management activities, and it probably has something to do with this passive-active discussion that you're talking about. What should be included, and does it have to be in paper form, or you know what's it supposed to look like?
Yeah, real quickly, no, not in paper form. We can do everything on computers now or handheld devices. As long as you keep an adequate record of what you're doing, we're battling two issues. One is a hobby loss issue, and the other issue is trying to prove that we materially participate in our activities. So what I'd want to do is see the individual landowner log the activity that they have, the date, time, tasks performed, what property they own, just to substantiate their active participation. Because as you look like a business, you really are a business. Businesses look like businesses, and it's almost redundant, but that's what we want to do is we want to say, okay, we've got a business running here, and this we keep business-like records. So
okay.
That's what we're doing.
Yeah. Thanks, Henry. Appreciate that. Bo Broadbeck works with landowners through the Alabama Cooperative Extension. He's familiar with using your smartphone to develop maps. Hello, Bo.
How are you doing this morning?
If a landowner wants to do some basic mapping with his smartphone, what app would you suggest you look at?
There are a lot of apps that are out there. I've spent some time going through a few of them, and the price points on apps are all over the place, anywhere from free There's some apps out there at the, you know, $200 to $300 price point that really start to get you closer to a more formal GIS-type system.
Mm-hmm.
However, one that I've run across and actually ran it across from more of a recreational standpoint was MotionX GPS.
Mm-hmm. Say that again, MotionX?
MotionX GPS.
Okay. What capabilities do you see for this application? How can landowners expect to accomplish something with that app?
Well, as I said before, it's not a formal GIS app, so you're not going to be exactly collecting polygons, but it does have some very user-friendly capabilities. Right off the bat, it's got a very nice aerial image background. You can also toggle over to a topo map. So you just like using Google Maps on your iPhone, you have that very similar high-quality aerial imagery. And what you can do with this map is you can also toggle with how you're going to be using, collecting your data, whether you're going to be, like I said, this was a recreational app, so it can be hiking, biking, driving, skiing, whatever. And so if we're thinking about from landowners' use, you're probably going to toggle over towards more of a hiking. And then at that point, it allows you to collect waypoints, which are basically a specific point, a Latin long. And you can also toggle over and collect track data, which is basically a breadcrumb trail of waypoints that you can create and essentially enclose a specific area or a trail you're walking that you want to be able to map. And what's really nice about it is as you're walking around your property, you see something of interest. Maybe you run across a pine beetle spot, and you see it out there. You can collect the waypoint. You can also take a picture of that waypoint, geo-reference it to that spot, and then you can share that with maybe your forester. You can send it to him in an email, and it's going to go to him in a KMZ file, and then he can basically open that up on in an imagery software like Google Earth. And so you'll be able to open that up and be able to see what you're talking about. The very same thing if you wanted to map out some of your roads on your property, you're able to do a lot of that, and you're able to share those tracks.
Okay.
And so,
briefly, do you have any shortfalls that you'd like to point out in some of these applications?
Yeah, you're using an iPhone. That is not a formal GPS system, so as your cell phone service declines, you're going to see the accuracy decline. Cell phones use GPS assist. It uses a combination of towers and a GPS chip. The other one I found that was a little aggravating was that this app will not calculate area.
Okay.
And so that's one of the ones. There are some other apps that will calculate area, like the Esri ArcGIS app, but you can't share the data you collect.
No? Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Bo. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll talk to Pete Smallage about the Northeast Timber Growing Contest, but our next guest is Billy Thomas, and he has some thoughts about how many forest owners manage their property. Hello, Billy.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
The U.S. Forest Service says that many family woodland owners do not actively manage their woodlands. What advice would you have if they wanted to get started in active management?
Well, I think it comes down to information. Information is power, and a lot of people don't realize how many resources are available to help them. There's a tremendous amount of organizations, tremendous amount of websites, agencies. So there's a lot of help out there. So I'd encourage folks to familiarize themselves with the help. Great place to start is your local extension office.
How do woodland owners go about learning specific forestry practices or techniques to help them take better care of the woodlands?
Certainly. If you're not familiar with forestry, it can be a little bit intimidating at first until you get some awareness of what's going on. So I would encourage folks, attend field days, get out, walk the land with their forester. But if you're not able to do that, there's a tremendous amount of information on the Internet that's available. And at the University of Kentucky Department of Forestry, we've put up a bunch of videos, how-to videos, to help landowners with many aspects of forest management.
Okay. Well, any parting advice for woodland owners?
I would say get started. Trees are a relatively long crop, so the sooner we get started and growing and encouraging the right ones to grow, the better off we'll be. And then take advantage of the resources and the help that are available to help you.
Okay, good advice. There's plenty of stuff out there. Thanks, Billy. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, we've heard about an initiative of the New York Forest Owners Association called the Timber Contest. It seeks to engage private forest owners in a contest and gives them an opportunity to show off their timber stands. And along the way, they learn from forestry professionals and also from each other. Dr. Pete Smolich is with Cornell University, and he's with us. Hello, Pete.
Good afternoon.
What's the status of New York's private forest and relate it to what the timber contest is all about, please?
Okay. Two recent studies in New York, which would have general application throughout the Northeast, have identified some concerns with the potential for New York's forest to regenerate. So, and these studies were consistent with other studies that suggested there were problems. The extent of the problems is going to vary some depending upon your geographic location, but basically woodland owners need to be alert to, first, the impacts of deer, secondly, the abundance and prevalence of interfering vegetation, and then also the exploitative harvesting practices. And what the timber contest does, it's designed to help increase the awareness and knowledge that forest owners have for the things that are happening in their woods, and so if they're participating in the contest, they're going to be more alert to these concerns and the extent to which those concerns play out in their forest.
Okay. It looks like the timber contest is about timber production, of course, and if so, why should these participants be concerned about growing quality timber?
Well, timber production is central to the contest, as you can imagine from the name, and it is kind of the basic framework for the discussion. And timber is important because that's how most landowners in the Northeast are going to make money. However, the purpose of the contest is really about education and encouraging landowners to spend more time in their woods and be deliberate managers of their woods and understanding more so the ways that forests grow and how those forests function. So you can see that the focus is on timber, but it's really secondary to the potential to learn more about the forest.
Well, how do we know that the rules are level for everybody? It's a level playing field. How do you score the entries, and how do the winners win?
Well, that was a concern of ours because, you know, forests, of course, vary in their quality and their ability to grow quality timber. So we've designed three different categories for competition, and the contestants are judged based on the percentage of change in one of those three categories that include the total volume of wood, the board foot volume, or seedling height. And because one of the primary determinants of this variation in quality is soil, we're going to standardize those changes in volume or seedling height by soil quality through site index. And then that way an owner that has poor soils will be competitive with an owner who's on has better quality soils.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
All right. I was just going to say that the scoring then allows for competition from 1 year to the, or within a year from one contestant to the next, but over time, contestants will accumulate points, and then we'll be able to recognize those people who have persistence, even though they may not be annual winners.
Okay. Well, a very innovative program. We thank you for sharing it with us, Pete.
Thank you very much.
That's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Dave Tenney, Jordan Rappaport, Dave Jones, and Lenny Farley. And we also appreciate the contributions of Henry Barclay, Bo Broadbeck, Billy Thomas, and Pete Smolich. Each year in April, AFOA members gather for our annual meeting. This year we'll revisit Gunnersville State Park. The date is April 25th through 26th. As always, there'll be some outstanding speakers and a chance to meet other landowners, so we hope you can attend. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.